is going to convert some of the RF energy into heat. And the third thing, of course, is what we really wanted to do is to radiate to space. So if you have any doubt about whether or not your antenna has lost your materials, put 10 watts or 100 watts into the antenna for a couple of minutes, key down. Turn up the transmitter and walk over there and touch everything. You'll be amazed how sensitive that touch test is to loss. Let me drop. At the 100 watt level, if your antenna lost 1 or 2 watts of power, that means it's got 98% efficiency. 1 or 2 watts of power for 5 or 10 minutes into your antenna is going to create a perceptible amount of heat in the radiating section, the insulator at the bottom, somewhere. Your hand will feel that heat. If the antenna is ice cold, it's not dissipating any energy into heat. It has no mechanism to do that. If the standing wave ratio is reasonable, it's not reflecting it back to the transmitter. The only thing left after that is it's radiating into space, with one exception. Let me drop. And that is, if it is a quarter wave type antenna, and if you have a very inadequate counterpoise system, in other words, your ground plane radio, are too short, inadequate, lossy, or whatever, it could be coupling some of the energy into the earth around your antenna, heating up the worms in the wintertime, so to speak. That's much more difficult to detect. In the case of a half-wave antenna where the base impedance is a very high impedance, that's almost never a problem. But if it's a quarter-wave type radiator, yes, you got to worry about the integrity of your ground plane radio system. So whether the antenna is made out of all of those materials you mentioned, assuming it's a well-respected brand that's got a track record, that's usually not a problem. But by that thermal testing, touching test, you'll find out real fast if it's got any real loss in it. And if it doesn't, then the only thing left for it to do is to radiate that signal to space. Let's see if we have other people on the net tonight with opinions about the materials that go into a vertical antenna on HF frequencies. Give me a call with us right now if you've got experience or opinions. K2RI, that's in the tech net. In the case of your particular HF vertical antenna, Lynn, what brand name, what model number, are you thinking of buying one, and you're worried about the materials that it's made with? So what created this particular concern, Lynn? Give it B2QEQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I was either thinking of a homebrew. A couple of plants I've seen utilize actually collapsible fishing poles. They really go up to about 30 feet. You know, they collapse telescope one into the other. But they're basically made out of what they call carbon steel kind of thing. I don't know, it must be plastic with some kind of conductivity into it. Because they generally make an effort to put some sort of foil or copper between the sections of that telescope. I don't know, maybe I'm just looking for a lot of trouble with it, but I'm just curious. The matter of expense doesn't really make that much difference. The ones that are pre-made compared to buying parts are about the same. I'm just interested if one was better than the other. Anybody else can come in and pick it up, I'd appreciate it.
E2FIU, George.
You got it, George.
Do you have an actual interest in a portability of this antenna, or do you want it fixed?
Oh, it'll definitely be fixed. Definitely fixed in the backyard.
My preference is aluminum tubing, without a doubt, for its durability. An ability to handle weathering. I don't know if I made up a word there, but also its ability to tune when you have multiple sections with clamps, easily tunable. How high off the ground do you want the antenna to be mounted?
Either ground level or maybe 6 to 8 feet high.
My experience is if you're going to go 6 to 8 feet high, you're going to need ground plane radios, without a doubt. At ground level, there's no magic antenna manufacturer that's going to get you a better signal at ground level. A radiator, a vertical radiator at ground level is going to deal with the quality of ground that you're mounting it in, or the loss, or lack of loss to the ground. But if you're going to go 6 to 8 feet high, you can go with a design called an out and up, where you're actually not using ground at all. And you're folding your antenna as a dipole. And you can use it where you have a radiator. And by the way, I won't go further. What frequency, what band are you looking to work with?
I suppose 10 to 40. I'm not interested in 80. But 10 to 40 meters is good.
At 10 to 40 meters, there's a lot of ways to tune that differently. There's a lot of ways to actually calculate the height of the antenna, whether you want to go random or whether you want to go first band, tuned, resonant, trapped above it with traps above that to give you resonance in 1, 2, or 3 bands above that. Keep in mind, either of these antennas would require ground isolation or grounding with radios, ground plane radios. The out and up antenna would be actually folding a dipole. Now you're ground isolated. You have your radiator, and your other pole is now horizontal. And you want that 7 feet or more above ground, not more than 10 feet above ground, because you don't want it to be your dominant pole. Let me let it recycle. The isolated antenna is actually taking a dipole and folding it. Folding it at 90 degrees or better, maybe 120 degrees. And you have your one, let's go with a monopole to start with before we go into multiple antennas here. The monopole would give you your resonant frequency measurement and slightly more, maybe 100 degrees, 120 degrees downward, out. No more than 7 or 10 feet above the ground, you put the same measurement in a distance with a wire. Very effective. It's called the out and up dipole. Used a lot after World War II by West Coast operators. This is insulated from ground. You are working with a vertical and a horizontal dipole antenna at the same time. Now you can take it another way. Get closer to the ground and use that same format with many radios closer to the ground. More effective. Much more effective. You could take it the other way and put it much more higher, more than 15, 20, 30 feet up in the air, and use the radio. If you want to use more than one band, you could either go with traps in the vertical, and let me recycle it. And different lengths of radios horizontally, or like I said, closer to 100 degrees away from 90. And or you can go, like I said, go with a trap vertically and go with multiple radials. Now, the radials themselves, let's say you want three bands. The radials can be triple wire, where within each of those three wire runs, you have cuts of wires equivalent to the resonance of the other pole of the band that you need. And you could do that with two, three, or four versus running all different lengths of radials. I prefer aluminum for the vertical and copper or aluminum for the horizontal run. I work one right now, very small, very effective on 10, 15, and 20 meters. I put this together myself. KD2FIU.
Do you need any show on any of that information, Len? KB2QEQ, K2LHW, go ahead.
Oh, I got a world of information. Really don't know where to begin thanking you. Really appreciate it. I got a lot to digest here. Gotta do some looking up and some refiguring. Blew a lot of my ideas out of the water, but this is most interesting. I like what Bob was said here. I'm sorry I don't remember the fellow's name. KD2FIU, I believe. Very helpful. I appreciate it very much. Like I said, it gave me a lot to think about, especially since I don't want to go with an awful lot of radials in the ground. That's just not for me here. I don't have the space for it. I just can't do it. But I can see there's something in between I might be able to use here. Probably I'm going to lean towards a trap, a couple of traps, in the vertical. I'm going to go that way. Thank you again, and I'm still here. This is WB2QEQ.
Can I leave a personal contact? Because I just put one of these together.
Go right ahead with that information, George. I think it's WB2FIU. You got it, George.
WB2QEQ, KD2FIU, contact me at Radio Fever, radiofever@att.net. We'll hook up, that's my email, and I'll give you some ideas and some very stealthy ways of putting up a vertical that works low-angle DX.
I had the impression, George, that you're strongly in favor of homebrewing a vertical antenna as opposed to buying one of the respected brands, and I guess part of that reason is that you'd like to save some money, and I don't blame you. I guess many of the vertical antennas that are popular are a little bit pricey. Is that part of the reason why you homebrewed it, or you just really enjoy tinkering with antennas? KD2FIU, K2LIW.
The vertical antennas is my frontier with this hobby. And there's one portion of it that I don't homebrew, and that's quality traps, if you want to go with that. I'll homebrew inductors with magnet wire and stuff like that, but when it comes to a capacitive inductive trap, they're easily you can purchase them. But the different designs, different heights, different needs, based on the amount of land, lack of land, height that you want to work with, all of this, I've really gotten into a lot of it. And I like working vertical antennas. That's my frontier. Not all of it, Dick, is going to be homebrew. Some of it, I think that you go and you say you'll purchase it. Like I said, the trap. You buy a quality trap. If you want to go in that direction, KD2FIU.
Now, George, for the people who want to follow your philosophy, where they want to buy a commercially made trap because it's sturdy, strong, weatherproofed, and so on, as opposed to homebrewing it, what brand name do you go to? What model number did you use? Roughly how many dollars? So where do you go to get these traps, Louis? Even in the old days, you couldn't walk into Radio Shack and say I want a trap that takes my 10-meter antenna and makes it work on 40 meters. Radio Shack didn't have a product like that. KD2FRU, K2RIW in the tech man.
His station ID came in there. Well, I make my own inductors when it comes to just inductive isolation to lengthen an antenna. When it comes to traps, I buy high gain.
So I think you're saying high gain has a whole series of traps, and they give you enough information to tell you where to place it and how long the rest of the radiator should be so that the trap does what it's supposed to do. Does high gain have all that information with their traps? And roughly how many dollars for the traps are we talking about here, George? Go ahead.
So they sell the traps based on replacements for antennas that are in place. Antennas that they market. So what I'll do is I'll study the antenna that they've marketed and then determine if that trap plugs into my plan. And with that, a trap could be anywhere from $30 to $55. If you want that, their traps are very robust. And, like I said, the first thing is that you study the antenna that they marketed the trap with. Downloading the antenna, the specifications, how it's mounted, how it's placed, everything. And then you look at the trap and say, okay, does this fall into where I want it in my vertical antenna? And looking at the specifications of the trap. Understanding, of course, a trap resonates anywhere from about 300 to 800 kilohertz below, maybe sometimes when you get lower bands, it goes even more. The trap does not trap the frequency precisely where you want it to end. It's going to be below because you don't want it to actually trap off and close the band you want to work. KD2FIU.
So what you're doing is you're studying high gain commercial product antennas that contain traps and then buying those traps. In other words, high gain thinks that you're replacing a trap on one of their antennas. They don't necessarily know that you're doing what you're doing and just using their replacement product for one of their antennas as something that you add to your antenna. So I think you're saying, is that correct, George?
KQRIW. WB2QEQ, just a quick question for George, please. I didn't get his whole email address. Just give it to me again and I'll get out of the way. Thank you.
KD2FIU, radiofever at att.net.
George, thank you very much. Thank you again.
And Dick, your answer, yes, I started out with a high gain product, their smallest trap antenna, and found it very, very effective. What happened was is I also realized that if I went with this method, I could build other vertical antennas, and I did. One at ground level. The first one I started with is about maybe 15 feet in the air, and I counterpoised, like I said, the ground plane radials, which were multiple wires. It was a three-band antenna that I started with two traps, and I went with three wires within each ground plane run, aerial ground plane run, sloping toward the ground, each of those having a tuned segment of wire for a quarter wave of the band that I wanted to work. Let me reset. Then I realized that in studying traps and in studying in inductors for a long wire, I also made the 40-80 horizontal long wire dipole, which I was talking about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago on here, very effective, the 80-foot long one. And I was talking about tuning the tails after the inductor. I also made an 18-foot vertical aluminum ground-mounted with three traps, giving me 10, 15, 20, and 40 if I ever wanted to work 40. In rare occasions, vertically, if you need it for that kind of angle, it's not always very effective compared to the high wire. Let me let it recycle. The antennas don't have to be ground dependent. If you tune them right, if you absolutely bring your choking of your feed lines to a point, you're actually making an up and out antenna. A dipole in so sense that you're not relying on ground as your radiator. Dick, over to you, KD2FIU.
Yeah, that's very good information. Dipole is a thoroughly balanced antenna. In other words, the transmission line, at one instant at a time, if it's got the right kind of a balancing device, is launching current into the right-hand side of the dipole and subtracting it from the left-hand side on that half cycle. And the next half cycle, it reverses that process, but it's a thoroughly balanced antenna. So no grounding is required on a dipole. An astronaut could be using a dipole in space, literally, he's doing a spacewalk. He's a kilometer away from the space station or from the space shuttle, so to speak, and operating his dipole would work like a charm. In the case of antenna design for the previous many decades, everyone believed that the antenna itself had to do all of the impedance matching and radiating. Nowadays, with wide brand antenna tuners, the antenna doesn't have to be resonant anymore. Obvious by what's going on inside of cell phones. The cell phones have got a super small antenna in there, and it's all internal these days. There's not even a little whip sticking out. Let me drop. And as long as there's an antenna tuner nearby, between the transmission line and that antenna, it forces it into resonance. So, if you've got a broad enough bandwidth on your antenna tuner, and as long as your feed line is low enough in loss, because the antenna tuner is at the antenna or it's a low loss line like open wire line, you don't even need traps. You don't even need to resonate the antenna. The antenna tuner can take that over. So we have many choices these days. You must resonate the antenna in order for it to radiate well. The antenna radiating system must be resonant. That means antenna plus tuner plus transmission line plus tank circuit of the transmitter. That whole combination must resonate to radiate well. But we used to be forcing with traps, all kinds of doodads, making the antenna itself the primary resonance at the frequency of operation. That's no longer a restriction. So we've got more options open to us these days with good antenna tuners. The main thing I'm a little bit disappointed about, let me drop, is that the manufacturer of the antenna tuner will give you a vague piece of information, like it will match any impedance up to a 3-to-1. Well, even that particular antenna tuner, that'll match any impedance up to a 3-to-1, at certain phase angles of the reflected power from the load, it probably will match a 10-to-1. So what the antenna tuner manufacturer should really do, if he's doing a thorough job, that he should present to you a Smith chart. And on that Smith chart, he colors in the portion of the Smith chart where the impedances in that portion of the Smith chart, his antenna tuner will cover it. And it's not going to be just a circle. It's going to be a crazy-shaped object. And you need a Smith chart for the 40-meter band and a Smith chart for the 80-meter band. It's a fair amount of data, but that's what's really required. The next step is that if you know the design, if you can get a hold of the schematic of this antenna tuner, and you know how big the inductor is with its taps and how big the variable capacitors are, then in theory you can calculate that. But where this is important is that by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, the Brown and Woodward curves are available on LimeOutTechNet.com as well as AmateurRadio.TangoVictor. You can get a hold of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. If you know the length of your wire and the diameter of the wire and the frequency you're operating at, you can predict the exact impedance of your method of feeding that particular piece of wire. And then if you could go to this Smith chart from your antenna tuner and say, yeah, that dot on the chart represents the impedance of my antenna on 40 meters, and my antenna tuner will cover that. And then you've closed the loop, if you know what I mean. And there's ways you can calculate that. But we've got lots of choices here. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this particular subject before we go over to...
Repeater, time out.
Anybody? One quickie on this, KD2FIU.
Go ahead, George. Wait for the beeps.
What got me started on all of this was when I purchased, 4 years ago, purchased a commercially made antenna that I couldn't figure out how it, vertical antenna, I couldn't figure out how it worked with all of its tuning rods. And to mention to anybody out there, read about the capacitive end fed off center dipole. From there, you're going to learn a lot about how to take vertical antennas and resonate them for the different environment you want and get the maximum capability. Capacitive end fed off center fed dipoles. It doesn't mean you have to feed it at the ends with capacitors. When I learned about that, I realized a lot of what I can do vertically from center feeding it. KD2FIU.
And your whole purpose of making the antenna resonate, radiate, is to couple energy into it, usually from your transmission line. And there's nothing magic about feeding the antenna in the center, 25% off to one side, the end. If you've got the right kind of impedance matching device, like a broadband antenna tuner, or in some cases you add an extra LC network of your own, you can feed the antenna anywhere you want. It's a little bit similar to having a flywheel with a push rod, like the push rod going to the main wheel on a locomotive. And you can feed it at the high impedance point, which means you're connecting the push rod near the perimeter of the wheel, or you can feed it at the low impedance point, where the push rod is fed very close to the axle, so to speak. Well, feeding an antenna at the end, the middle, or off to one side, those are some of your choices. I can know a little bit about what Lou is going to be running into here. He's got so many choices nowadays, and choosing the right one for him. In many cases, it doesn't matter. As long as you can get the energy there, impedance match it, and forcing in everything into resonance, then you've got a lot of different ways you can do it that can fit onto your particular piece of property. I'm going to go over to Joe now. We've kept him waiting long enough. So B2LYY, T2LAW, go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. I'd like to go over something you talked about in the past, just so I guess understand it more technically about how a specification works, and that is related to a DTV converter. The specification I'm looking for, I've heard sensitivity mentioned as, say, 7 dB. Okay, and that's all I've heard. I've never heard that mentioned to what that's reference to. Is that reference to the equivalent bandwidth that it's receiving, of course, or is there something else involved with that measurement also or specification?
Yeah, here Eric would be the man to give us a better answer on this, but I'm going to make some guesses. Each one of our television channels in the United States are 6 megahertz wide. So your digital converter, if it's ideal, it's got a 6 megahertz rectangular bandpass filter letting in those frequencies and nothing else. And across that 6 megahertz of bandwidth, if your carrier-to-noise ratio is 27 dB, then I think the manufacturer is telling you he's going to have a very low bit error rate in his digital demodulation of that particular signal. So I'm pretty sure we're talking about carrier-to-noise ratio rate across a 6 megahertz bandwidth. I'm going to pass it over to Eric if he's available to give us a confirmation on this. KE2EJ, if you're there, Eric. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, it's not exactly carrier to noise, okay? Actually, it's an interchangeable figure that we use, which has more meaning, right? It's called EVM, or error vector modulation, and we actually read that in percentage. That 27 dB, which you would normally consider signal noise, that's actually an error rate value. The concept is that once you get beyond 27 dB or an EVM of less than 3, your demodulator is going to demodulate. And the higher that figure is, or the lower the EVM figure is, the less of a hard time the equalizer's in the receiver and the decoding circuitry actually has to work. So you can think of it as carrier to noise, but it ain't really.
If I wanted to calculate whether or not my system was good enough, Eric, if I knew the effective radiated power of the broadcast station, I knew the altitude of its antenna, I know the miles to my QTH, I've got an estimate as to how many trees are getting in the way. If I knew the ERP of the broadcast station, and I knew something about my particular aerial of my house, I might be able to calculate how strong a signal I get. And then I could compare that signal across the 6 meg bandwidth to calculate the signal-to-noise ratio and hope it's 27 dB. Is it possible to do a calculation like that, or is this EVM process a little more spooky than that? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, there's a couple of different figures, like carrier to noise. A DTV set is really an analog set at first, until there's enough signal to let the balanced demodulators, actually, and a lot of it is done via A to D. Once there's enough signal to be able to split it into I and Q, after that point, there's another set of values to come in, and that's the 27 dB number that we hear. It's actually that number that comes in the second stage of the process of modulating a digital signal. So, you might notice on some TV sets that it'll give you a signal strength before the thing locks up, and then it gives you a different kind of a signal strength or a number that it starts at and continues from. Different manufacturers have different ways of putting it. But you can figure in terms of how much RF is coming down your antenna. Let me grab. There's going to be a minimal amount of signal that it's going to take before the digital part of the receiver kicks in. And from that point, okay, you could actually increase the amount of signal going into the set from the antenna and not actually affect that 27 dB number. you could have your receiver going at, say, 27 to 28, or an EVM of, say, 1%, and then increase the input to the tuner by, say, 15 or 20 dB or 10 dB in microvolt, not microvolt. Got a safety incentive cable. What do they call it? DBMV. Thank you. And that's the significant increase in the EVM or the SNR number that we're used to looking at. That's really all about the quality of the signal and its ability to be decoded.
From what you're telling me, Eric, it doesn't seem to be a very simple way that I can take ERP and path loss and gain of my receiving antenna and come up with a easily defined carrier-to-noise ratio, signal-to-noise ratio, assuming I don't have very much local noise. Could it be rated in microvolts? In other words, I might be able to calculate the microvolts coming out of my antenna terminal going into the receiver system. So, if I can't take signal strength and 6 megs of bandwidth to calculate carrier-to-noise ratio, if there's no direct process of doing that, is there a direct process in microvolts? Or is it even more spooky than that? So, you've told me how complicated it is and how difficult it is to make this calculation. I'm being slowly led to believe that we're down to only making the measurements that we can't calculate. And I hope it's not like that. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, if you want to go by the way the cable folks operate, or TV antenna installers work, and we'll work with their system of numbers, which is DBMV, which is, what is it, 1,000 millivolts to zero? Anyway, if you go back to your analog days of TV sets, to get a really solid picture that doesn't have snow in it, most receivers need it somewhere between minus 15, minus 10 dBm in order to make a decent picture. For that aspect of it, those rules exactly apply. You can take the distance from the station, the ERP of the station, the gain of your antenna, and you got to figure if you've got more than minus 10 dBmV getting into your tuner, you're in good shape. That's one aspect of it. Then, at that stage of the game, kick in and go to the second part, which is the error rate. And in most of the broadcast here that's not related to the TV set, like microwaves and other things like that, we call it an EBNO, or an error bank number. And that's usually a number with a exponent on it. And what it really is the amount of error correction that's going on. Same thing with the digital television. After you reach that point where the receiver can lock up to it, now you have a different set of calculations, which is based upon the error correction that's occurring within the set to make the picture.
Among the cable company technicians, DBMV is the main unit that they frequently use measuring the quality of the signal coming down the cable, coming into your QTH. I think DBMV is decibels with reference to 1 millivolt, dB millivolt. And a millivolt is a pretty strong signal, obviously, by the fact that our handy jockey on 2 meters can listen to a quarter of a microvolt and get a good carrier-to-noise ratio out of that. So, but the television set's got a lot more bandwidth, so the fact he told me that a DBMV of minus 20 DBMV might be acceptable, so because a millivolt is 1,000 microvolts, which is 60 dB above a microvolt. 1 millivolt is 60 dB above a microvolt. 20 log of volt 1 over volt 2, so to speak. So, therefore, that's a huge signal. 60 dB over a microvolt is a millivolt, and minus 20 dB from that is 1/100th of that power, 1/10th of that voltage. So, minus 20 dBmV is probably 100 microvolts. So, as long as we know the DBMV required and that's calculatable, assuming you know the ERP. Is that a fairly simple way of doing a calculation when you're trying to decide, is my antenna big enough, is it high enough, and am I close enough to the broadcast station? KE2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
K2RW, K2J. That works as a general rule. Though the numbers are a little higher than what you would find acceptable for analog, but yeah. Although, interestingly enough, the new standard actually lowers that number. Oh, and I've got a funny story to tell you. Oh, by the way, have you seen channel 13-3 lately?
Yeah, I think it's called the Biz Channel. And that's something that's aired. Go ahead and tell us your funny story. We're in the mood for a funny story. You got it, Eric.
All right. As of right now, WNJU is broadcasting from World Trade Center. And they had moved from Empire. Now, this is the best part. There's a bunch of antennas on the 81st floor setback. And NJU wanted their microwave and their camera and a couple other things removed. Well, on the day that that's supposed to happen, and after that actually happened, ABC lost their microwave, they lost their ENG disc, they lost their camera looking out towards the park, and the camera pointed south. Well, the folks who actually took the antennas off for NJU took off the wrong antennas.
Oops. That's a real blank. There's all kinds of words you can plug in there. I presume that somebody had to do some tall explaining on that one. And I presume the equipment to be removed was not properly labeled. That's part of what's going on. And the people doing the removing didn't recognize brand A versus brand B. You got it, Eric.
Now, there's words that I could use that I can't use on the radio, but the demolition was done by the building management, which is Empire, and they have a history of having problems. So, and because of that now, we actually need to move one of our antennas down to World Trade, and they're making this big hullabaloo about doing a couple of pounds of paperwork and demolition and getting it approved and all of this stuff to let them take the antennas off there now. So it's made a lot of people really very unhappy all the way around.
So once this was discovered, how long did it take to correct the problem, Eric?
Well, it seems that nobody's been able to find their gear and they suspect that it went into the trash.
Wow. And we're probably talking about some fairly expensive gear, which probably has a vanishing vendor. Therefore, replacing it today could be a little bit difficult. Is that true? In other words, the guy's removing the material, and you'd like to be there to take the material. They're just simply going to throw it in the trash. Wow. What a bunch of errors here. Back to you, Eric.
Oh, the funny thing is, many of the tenants in the building are not surprised. We've had stories like that in the past, and that's really funny. Oh, by the way, I put up an 8-foot dish on my tower here that's looking at World Trade. Got a nice pass to the World Trade Center now. And I actually cook and made movies of all that stuff. Actually, I didn't get a chance. I want to show you what they did to the tower to reinforce the base. Oh, by the way, the 13-3, you'll notice in the upper right-hand corner it says WMBQ. This is part of a channel sharing agreement. They actually sold the frequency for $28 million. And so through a channel sharing agreement, they're still on the air, but they're just on 13-3. But in the sometime in the near future, the virtual channel is going to change.
MBQ is licensed where, and what service are they? What channel number were they on? I don't recognize that call letter. Maybe I should.
Yeah, they were based in New York City. They were in Empire. But their coverage area is basically the five boroughs.
Now, Joe, as I see it, DBMV I'd like to believe that your service monitor has a routine where you can set it into a measuring signal strength and dB with reference to a millivolt. And so knowing that a minus 20 dBmV signal strength from the channel you want to watch is likely to give you good digital demodulation. Does your service monitor do that? If it measures microvolts and you've got a calculator, you can calculate dBmV. To be E2LYY, T2LAW, great show.
Now, just remember, all the industrial-made stuff that does dBmV is designed to 75 ohms.
Yeah, 75 versus 50 is a very small difference. That's a fraction of a dB. That's not a showstopper, I think. Go ahead, Joe.
It still sounds like you're not directly answering the question I originally asked, and that's what I'm trying to get the answer for. You know, is that figure 27 dB, is that reference to the noise floor at 6 megahertz, which I calculated out to be 102.6 or something like that. Minus dBm, minus 106.2 or something like that, dBm. So that figure 27, is that theoretically above that level? Or is it reference to some level? Because a dB is a reference to some level you have to specify. By itself, it means nothing.
It would have to be 6 megacycles, as we said to you earlier, because the channel is 6 megs wide. To my knowledge, there's nothing on the front end of a digital demodulator that is more restrictive than 6 megacycles. Downrange, or noise equivalent bandwidth, by way of digital signal processing, can be any number in the world. But at the front end, I would guess everything is referenced to 6 megacycles. I live in the 1 megacycle reference world. Minus 113 dBm per megahertz is KTB. In other words, a 290 degree Kelvin resistor has a noise power close to 1 meg bandwidth of minus 114 dBm per megacycle. And then if I go from 1 megacycle to 6 megacycles, it's about an 8 or a 9 dB detriment from there. That's how we came up with the number you just came up with. So I would guess it's with reference to 6 megs. Let's see if Eric can confirm that, because what noise equivalent bandwidth you get downrange would get kind of complicated. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
All right, to answer both of you guys' questions, no, it's not a reference to carry the noise or noise floor or anything like that. It is a reference to zero demodulation or the inability of a demodulator to demodulate, and it's the increasing ability to demodulate a signal, okay? You know, if you've got a noisy signal and you have a lot of signal levels, you're still going to have this lousy number. As your signal becomes less noisy, okay, and noise doesn't necessarily mean noise in the traditional sense. It's really inter-symbol distortion we're talking about. Reflections, atmospheric noise, a whole collection of things. Yes, when the signal gets weak enough, the impulse noise of nature's noise impresses itself on it. As you get closer to the source of transmission or you increase the gain, the ratio between nature's noise and the actual impulse noise of the signal increases. So that's why it's not a clear cut, you know, I've got a carrier, it's X number of dB above the noise floor. It's sort of a case of that, but not really.
I think I can get there.
If that's how it is. Now I'll give you a comment. Since RF-30 moved from location A to location B, they're about 10 dB stronger, approximately, than anything else coming out of New York City in the UHF spectrum. Here's something you probably might find a little hard to believe. I can rotate the antenna 360 degrees and only get occasional picture pixelation, but I do not lose the signal on RF-36 anymore. Can't do that with any other New York channel. Height is might, I guess, right?
You're going to have to repeat that for me, because I'm not sure I followed what you said, and I'm not sure I heard it correctly.
Yeah, Yeah, first he talked about channel 30, then he talked about channel 36. But obviously somebody moved to World Trade. They're higher, therefore stronger. And which channel was that? And tell us whether or not you're talking about the advertised channel number or the real RF channel number. Over to you, Joe. WRYY, KQRIW, and TechNet.
I don't think I said 30, I said 36. Pretty sure I said that. Yeah, October, I always talk about the RF channel. I'm not talking about the DTV brand that you see on your television or your converter. I'm talking about the RF channel. And that's what I use with my instrumentation to measure. When I look, you know, when I look at other channels, it's about 10 dB stronger on RF channel 36 than any other UHF emission coming out of New York City. It's just about as strong as RF 21 coming out of Plainview. Now, here's the funny thing. I could turn my antenna 360 degrees and get only occasional picture pixelation, where the picture will freeze a moment and it comes back, but I don't completely lose lock. If I try doing that with RF 21, I do lose the picture as the antenna goes around. Funny, isn't it?
All right, now I can explain that. 36 is virtual 47, which is WNJU. They right now are the only station operating on top of the World Trade Center. That's why you see them 10 dB stronger. And by the way, this is another interesting thing. They're on the top of the spire. Now, the spire pipe itself has different radius. So they're on the skinniest pipe. And that antenna, I'm going to tell you how it's made. Let me let it drop. That antenna is actually a series of panels, okay? The panels are both horizontally and vertically polarized. There are five columns on the top spire, and there are eight rows, okay? The next spire down, which actually has more gain and more antennas, it has 12 columns and eight rows of panel antennas. But the problem is there, somebody made the phasing harnesses for this. They were done defectively. Some of them, they were crimps. There was all sorts of problems. They're in the process of making 190-odd new phasing harness before that antenna, which has even more gain, goes into operation. And by the way, the VHF antenna is being stalled because the second-tier UHF antenna is being worked on at the moment. So, you know, we want to be on the air from World Trade by December, but it seems like that might not happen. KQRIW, K3JX.
When you're setting up all these panels for a certain diameter of the mast you're mounting them to, that dictates the length of some of the lines of the phasing harness. So if it was made for one diameter of mounting a pole, and it was mounted on another diameter, that phasing harness could be in error. Therefore, you might have a more scalloped pattern around the azimuth, around the horizon. Is that sort of true, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, well, the way that's correct. The way that the antenna is designed for that, the broadband, you know, they handle the entire UHF band, and the bees will handle, at this point, from what I'm aware of, just the high bees, and then there's a plan for low bees if they should come, but nobody thinks they're coming. Actually, the mass filters and combiners that's there is only capable of the high bees. So, since the upper antenna is in operation, you know, they made the correct number of harnesses and combiners to make that operate. They also made the correct number of harnesses and so on and so forth for the next tier antennas, but they were defective in manufacture, so that's what's holding this whole project up. And as they're getting the new stuff and to hook them up, there's also the problem of weather and the guys climbing up there, and, you know, you can't do it every time you want. It gets really windy and cold.
So, Channel 36 RF is on the top. Everything's working great. That's why it's so strong. The next guy down who has the defective phasing harness, what RF channel number was he going to go on, Erica? Go ahead.
No. Again, they're all combined in a combiner. They're all using the same antenna. The top sphere is actually the standby UHF antenna. The one down, which has the more gain, is going to be main. So that's the difference between the two.
The next level down, is that going to contain essentially all of the UHF channels, Eric, or even some of the upper and lower Vs? You got it, Eric.
Now, these antennas are designed strictly for the UHF band. As more stations come online that will trade, they will be using, until the second tier antenna is ready, they will also be using the top tier antenna. And the VHF antenna is a little bit below that. So, if you actually look at the... have a pair of binoculars and you look at the top of the World Trade Center, you'll see 1, 2, 3 sets of little separators, and that's where the antennas are grouped. And if you look at the rings themselves and you happen to be looking east, you'll see a big dish that's looking at my station.
Very nice. And that's pulling a lot of RF into plain view. In the old days, UHF television was Brandon channel 14 to 84, 470 to 890 megahertz. More recently, I think we're branded 14 to 51. I think we didn't go above 51 most recently. And now with the new changes being made, I think we're not going to go anything above branded something like 31 or so. What's the new maximum branded channel going to be when everything settles out in the next couple of years? KE2EJ, KQIW.
K2IW, KJJ. All right, let me just straighten out your vocabulary a little bit here. Okay, there's the RF channel. And there's the other thing called the virtual channel. The thing that the viewer sees is the virtual channel. They don't see the RF channel. The virtual, meaning the channel's virtual, meaning that it can be anything you want it to be. Actually, if you turn around, you'll see that there's a channel 68. There could be a channel 100. It just doesn't really matter. It's whatever the branding that the station originally had before the digital transition that everybody knew that Channel 4 was Channel 4. And that meant it was NBC, and Channel 2 was CBS, and so on and so forth. So there's really no reason to change it for the traditional channel. So that's why they came up with this virtual idea, is you could be on any RF channel but still maintain your branding. So, new stations that come on, if they're in different parts of the country, they actually take the RF channel and make it their branding. But actually, we're losing more TV stations than we're gaining at the moment.
Okay, real RF channel number. What's the highest that's being used now? And when all of the changes settle out, what's the highest RF channel number that will be used? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Nice. The highest RF channel after, in this area, 2019, I think the highest one is 34. Either 39, I gotta look at it again, because either 35 or 37 is the national quiet, RF quiet zone for Greenbelt. And it's everything below that. And above that is now the paid for communications, public service, blah, 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 cell phone, etc.
West to west. Okay, that's the new, 34 or so is the new. Currently, what's the highest RF channel being used over the last 2 years, Eric?
Well, it was 52, but they got moved down to 8 because T-Mobile has a big pocketbook. But I think the highest one right now, if you want to count what you can pick up on Long Island, which isn't necessarily what should be Connecticut, I think 49 is still operating. I know in Jersey there's a 50, and I think the highest one here is is it? 40 something. 40, I think it is, yeah. It's YWK2J.
I wasn't talking about just Long Island.